New Books Network, New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. My name is Banafsheh Madani-Nejad. Today we have the great pleasure of talking to Maryam Al-Attar. Maryam holds a PhD in Islamic Ethics from the University of Leeds in the UK. She has taught ethics, Greek philosophy, Western modern philosophy at the University of Jordan. And she's also taught at King's Academy in Jordan, where she was teaching Islamic studies, ethics, and world religions. And now she is a visiting scholar at the American University of Sharjah, where she teaches. She also, on top of all the other stuff that she's taught, she's also teaching a course on Arabic heritage, which is offered by the Department of Arabic and Translation Studies. She is the author of the monograph Islamic Ethics, The Place of Divine Command Theory in Arabo-Islamic Thought, which came out in paperback in 2012. And that's the book that we are going to ask her about today. All right, Maryam, how are you doing? It's so great to have you with us.
I am fine. Thank you, Banafsheh. It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about yourself, like where you were born, where you went to school, how you became interested. This is my favorite question: how you became interested in Islamic ethics, and whether or not you had a mentor.
Well, I was born in Slovenia. I don't need to mention the date, I think. I was born in Slovenia to a Jordanian father, to a Jordanian father and Slovenian mother, where I lived like for 8 years before moving to Jordan. I attended the school in Jordan and I did my bachelor degree in physics. Then I worked in the field of medical physics for around 15 years. During that time, I was doing my master in philosophy, which was kind of a hobby for me. And after having two kids, after raising two kids, I decided to pursue my passion for philosophy and to go and to study PhD in Islamic ethics at Leeds with my supervisor. My mentor there was Professor Ian Netten. I also need to mention the other professor, my supervisor of master degree in Jordan, the late Dr. Sahbani Khalifa, who always encouraged me to finish and to go on to study the PhD. He always encouraged me, regardless of having the kids, being busy with different things. He said that you have to go on to finish your studies. So he was my first mentor. My other mentor was Professor Ian Netter, who also was a great support for me during the work on my PhD. Yes.
Yeah, awesome. Did you have any female mentors, women mentors?
Unfortunately, I didn't have any female mentors, but I had a wonderful friend and who was also my examiner for PhD, Dr. Zahia Salhi, who is now in Manchester, teaching in Manchester. And I work sometimes with her on other topics. She published a book in which I wrote a chapter, Dr. Zahia Salhi, otherwise no. I didn't have any mentors in the early stage of my studies, any female mentors.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let me ask you, the title of your book is Islamic Ethics, The Place of Divine Command Theory in Arabo-Islamic Thought. Can you elaborate on that title? And can I ask you what you mean specifically by ethics and why you're calling it Arabo-Islamic?
Ethics in this book is I'm considering ethics the philosophical study of morality, and Islamic ethics indicates that the title indicates that those who elaborated various views and theories of morality and who are studied in this book consider their work to be in agreement with the basic teachings of Islam, nothing else. And Arabic simply because I'm focusing on work written in Arabic, and Islamic because many of the scholars who worked on ethics were of non-Arab origin, were Muslims, but not Arabs.
Mm-hmm. So what, like, can you give us some examples of the people that you work on in the book? And specifically, I think you concentrate on two or three people. Can you give us an example of who they are and what their background was?
if we're talking about the Mu'tazila, most of the Mu'tazilite scholars were actually from Persian origin. And indeed, Al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar Al-Asad Abadi, he is from Ray, which is nowadays somewhere near Tehran, right? But he wrote a voluminous work in Arabic called Al-Mughni fi Abwab al-Tawheed wal-Adl, which is the main reference for my book, which is the main source of for my research.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Maryam, why ethics? Why did you decide to write about ethics? What is relevant about ethics in Islamic studies today, do you think?
Indeed, when I decided to do my PhD in Benashe, one of the things that I considered writing about was philosophy of science, taking into consideration my background in physics. However, we had many discussions with my previous previous mentor in the master's, and we were talking about the important issues that face the Arabo-Islamic thought in the modern era, and I thought that ethical issues are maybe the most important things that one has to deal with before any other issue. Ethics, where I lived, for example, was seen as totally connected or related to religion. Many people would say that what is good is whatever God commands, and what is evil is whatever God prohibits. So haram, halal are two concepts or two terms that people widely use in our societies. So I'm afraid that somehow people stop thinking about those terms. They are not linking them to good and evil, what is morally good and evil, as if divine commands and prohibitions have nothing to do with what is good for people and what is bad for people. So I thought, oh gosh, is it possible that in this very rich Arab-Islamic civilization, there are no thinkers, or there have not been any great philosophers or thinkers who actually thought about ethics in a way that you would want it to be thought of, like a rational, moral inquiry, philosophical inquiry? Didn't they think about the meaning of what is good and what is bad, what is evil and what is good? So that took me to the field of ethics, actually, and that took me to the Mu'tazila. I looked into the literature of those called philosophers like Farabi, Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, Al-Kindi, but mainly what you find in their work is philosophy or ethics in the way that has been done in Greek philosophy. So you can mainly find the virtue theories there. It has been brought to my attention that George Hurani, and his book was one of the first books that I read related to Islamic ethics, George Hurani, who wrote about Abdul Jabbar al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar al-Mu'tazili, or the chief judge, as he is known. And it grabbed my attention that, oh gosh, he is indeed talking about very important issues. And George Hurani was the first, maybe, who called the theory, which Al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar opposes, he called that theory a subjective, what is that? Not ethical voluntarism, not divine command theory, but it can be given another name, which is subjective ethics, subjective ethics, indicating that it comes from it is voluntaristic ethics or divine command theory. Yes.
Awesome. So you, that was a definite answer to the question. And this now, what you said as an answer made me think of another question. So if I understand you correctly, you saw a disconnect between what was the common good for the people or maslaha, and what the books considered good and evil. without putting much thought into it and assuming, having assumed that this is what God considers good and this is what God considers bad. So you saw sort of a disconnect between the lives that the people were living and what was considered good and evil as dictated by God. Considering how important this concept of maslaha has become in Islamic studies, could you sort of connect the two ideas, ethics and maslaha, and tell us what you think about how they're related?
Yeah, that takes us to a very important issue, Banafshe, indeed. In my book, I didn't really talk much about maslaha, but it is kind in the background of all the subject because...
Yes, it definitely
is. There's a great PhD dissertation which was written somewhere in the 50s by Mustafa Zaid in Damascus, and he argued that there is no Muslim jurist, no faqih, who didn't actually consider al-maslaha, which is human well-being, the ultimate purpose of any rule or law. So the ultimate purpose considered by any Muslim jurist, whether Maliki, Shafi'i, Hanbali, Hanafi, has been al-maslaha. And here we are talking about jurisprudence or al-fiqh or usul al-fiqh. And you know that al-maslaha is generally considered that it is a concept or that it is it was emphasized in the Maliki school of law. Now, somehow in the Arab Islamic tradition, we see kind of a separation between the usul al-fiqh and fiqh jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence and al-kalam or usul al-din, which is the principles of belief, the principles of religion. Now, somebody early on, like somebody like Abdul Jabbar and the Mu'tazilite thinkers, the Mu'tazilite theologians, if you wish, they didn't do this separation. They didn't separate between usul al-fiqh and usul al-din. Their books were simply called al-usul. So a book like Al-Mughni kind of combines both principles of jurisprudence and ilm al-kalam, or the principles of religion. Now, talking about maslaha and how that is linked to ethics, indeed, Al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar, although he doesn't use the term maslaha, that developed later on, because Al-Ghazali came almost 100 years after Al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar, he didn't use the term maslaha, but he did use the term al-nafa', al-manfa'a, al-qasd, al-maqasid. He used those terms, and he established that divine commands and prohibitions, they are there in order for the sake of human beings, in order to preserve their well-being, in order to that they are moral commands, that the morality comes first. Before the commands comes the morality. And that is certainly goes together with the doctrine of maslaha. Now, to what extent the Maliki school of law was influenced by the Mu'tazilite theology, I'm not 100% sure. It needs a very elaborate
another study. Dissertation.
Yes, it needs another dissertation for sure. But it is certainly the Mu'tazilites are actually not only those who established ilm al-kalam, they were also very closely involved in establishing the principles of jurisprudence, usul al-fiqh. And maslaha, although they don't sometimes state it explicitly, but maslaha is indeed not only one of the principles of jurisprudence or one of the sources of law in Islam, it is the ultimate source of law, which means that even God revealed the law, revealed the Quran in order to safeguard maslaha, in order to safeguard humans' well-being, individual and communal well-being of people.
Okay, so I guess this was a great introduction to the topic in general. Let me just ask you what the main concern of your book, and I'll give the title one more time, Islamic Ethics, the Place of Divine Command Theory in Arabo-Islamic Thought is. So the main concern of your book.
The main concern of the book, my dear, is to investigate the source and the nature of moral values and moral judgments in Arabo-Islamic thought. Yet the ultimate goal is to provide some new insights into Islamic ethics and partially participate in the general revival in the study of ethics in Islamic philosophy. So some ethical theories that seem to hinder the socio-political developmental process should be challenged. And towards this goal, this book focuses on divine command theory, which restricts the utilization of reason in the realm of ethics and Islamic law.
Okay, you use the word revival in the study of Islamic ethics. So you think that there's a revival in the study of ethics and in the Muslim world right now?
Yes, my dear, but remember this book was written in 2010 and as a soft copy in 2012. And indeed, the recent what is recently happening in the Arab land wasn't expected at that time. I wonder whether I would be motivated to write a book like this nowadays. But talking about the recent revival, you know, it's maybe somebody like Fazlur Rahman, like Khalid Abul Fadl. I have in my mind certain progressive Muslim thinkers who are trying to revisit some main doctrines, some main principles of Islamic jurisprudence and theology, and to construct some ethical theories that are compatible with Islam and at the same time compatible with modernity and critical philosophical thinking.
Well, Maryam, I asked you this question specifically because I do believe strongly that there is a revival in the study of ethics in the Muslim world. And I see it very clearly in Iran. So I hope you don't... I hope you don't give up just because politics is getting in the way. I would love to read some more of your books. Okay. So, all right, we talked about, excuse me, we talked about, you just talked a little bit about divine command theory. Can you tell us specifically what divine command theory is and what you suggest the prevailing theory that needs to replace that, which you call divine purposes theory, is? Could you tell us what the difference between divine purposes theory? And I believe this is sort of the main push of your book, sort of to describe what divine command theory is and give sort of a background as to what the big thinkers in medieval Islam thought, the ethicists in medieval Islam thought about that, and then propose that, in fact, they were thinking about what they were suggesting was something very different from divine command theory. And I will just give it over to you now.
Okay, my dear. Indeed, when we are talking about divine command theory, we shouldn't forget that it is not a theory that is mainly Islamic, or that it is the main theory, it existed only in Islam. We need to know that, gosh, divine command theory existed like much longer before Islam. It existed, as far as I know, in Judaism and in Christianity. It is the prevailing theory in Protestant ethics from Calvin and Martin Luther up to those who call themselves divine command theorists, like Philip Quinn, who died recently in 2004, and others. So divine command theory is not only Islamic. There are divine command theorists in different religions in the world. However, when we are talking about the place of divine command theory in Islam, we need to explain that some writers have seen Islam as a very clear example of ethical voluntarism or divine command theory.
But that's not the case. Can you explain what that is? Mariam, can you just give us a little background as to what that is?
Feynman theory is. Okay, we can say that it is a meta-ethical theory that interprets morality as obedience to commands. It is sometimes called theological voluntarism or divine subjectivism, as called by George Florani, or simply divine command theory. A divine command theory states that moral values, good and evil, have no meaning apart from divine commands and prohibitions. And according to this theory, divine command constitutes the ontological basis of morality, which means no good or evil really exists apart from what was commanded and what was prohibited. Now, indeed, that simply means that people who don't adhere to your religion, if you are a Muslim or a Christian or whatever, they simply have no access to moral knowledge. Because you can't even imagine, if you are a divine command theorist, you cannot even imagine good or evil, right or wrong, apart from commands and prohibitions, which are, of course, specific to your religion. Qadi Abdul-Jabbar, and that is his importance as a Mu'tazilite thinker, as early as the beginning of the 11th century, he refuted this theory. And one of the main arguments he had against the theory is that if this theory is right, and if there is no good and evil apart from what is commanded or prohibited by God, then those people who are non-believers wouldn't know what is good and what is evil. However, he observed that even non-believers, they know good and evil, they know what is right and what is wrong. So commands and prohibitions couldn't have possibly established morality. Yeah, and from here, the question was in Islamic, in Ilm al-Kalam, or what is usually translated into Islamic theology, is whether revelation establishes or indicates morality. Al-shar'a muthabbat am mubayyan. The answer of the Mu'tazila was al-shar'a mubayyan. وليس مثبت, that revelation simply indicates morality, it does not establish morality. That means that you can get to know what is right and what is wrong using your reason without revelation. That is possible. And that is how people from other religions and people who don't have a religion can have access to moral knowledge. So that is the importance of Abdul-Jabbar. And by the way, this conversation and this argument is still valid today. Some people still argue for divine command theory, and still people argue against divine command theory using the same argument that Abdul-Jabbar has used almost 1,000 years ago. Sorry, Banash, so the question was actually, so this is divine command theory. And my argument in the book was mainly that it is not the theory that prevails in Arabo-Islamic thought. The theory that prevails in Arabo-Islamic thought, I think, is divine purposes theory, usually called in Arabic Nazariyat Maqasid al-Sharia. Nazariyat Maqasid al-Sharia. And but we have a little problem here, because those people who started Nazariyat Maqasid al-Sharia were actually Asha'ira. And traditionally, Asha'ira, the other school of Ilm al-Kalam of theology, they were the Mu'tazila, and then the Asha'ira, established by Abu al-Hasan al-Ash'ari. Traditionally, Asha'ira are known to be the people who actually supported divine command theory. Al-Ash'ari clearly say that no, al-shari' muthabbat wa laysa mubayyan, and there is no good and evil apart from what is commanded or prohibited. Nazariyat Maqasid al-Sharia, or the divine purposes theory, was actually articulated by theologians who belong to the Ash'ari tradition. But what is the difference between what I would strictly call? What is the difference between what I would?
And here we have Islamic studies in a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
One side of your mouth says one thing, one side of the mouth says something else.
says another thing. No, I think I have to be clear on that point. I have to be clear on that point, Benafshe. Indeed, I think the next part of your question was, how come that I say that the prevailing theory was divine purposes theory, although the Asha'ira actually were the people who defended divine command theory? Well, Abu Hassan al-Ash'ari and the early Ash'arite theologians, they clearly fully supported divine command theory. But such a theory, which kinds of implies that there is no reason, no purpose behind what is commanded and prohibited, couldn't have provided the basis for practicing law in Islam, because fuqaha, those who work on fiqh, they always worked on the assumption that every command, every prohibition, something is prohibited or commanded for a reason. There is a purpose behind what is commanded and what is prohibited. And that's why even the late Ash'arite, like Fakhreddin al-Razi, for example, or even somebody like Ibn Taymiyyah, who is Hanbali from another tradition, they say that indeed all of the fuqaha were practically against divine command theory, that they were practically, they believed that there is objective standards for good and evil. But for some reason, even those late Ash'ari like Muhammad al-Ghazali, they kept the Ash'arite doctrine, which is that al-shara' muthabbit wa laysa mubayyan. He adhered to this established Ash'arite dogma, although on the other side, his theory of maqasid al-shari'a completely contradicts with divine command theory, because at the moment that you say that divine command has a purpose, has a reason, that means you are not divine command theorist, because if you are divine command theorist, there can't be a reason behind what is commanded and what is prohibited. Anything could be commanded and prohibited, and there is nothing that makes it good or evil but the command and the prohibition. Sorry, I have been talking too much, I think.
No, this was fabulous. It was exactly what I wanted you to tell us about. Okay, let me ask you. You just talked about what the difference is between divine command theory as far as early Ash'a'ira, the Ash'arites go, and I wanted you to tell us what divine, so specifically, can you tell me the difference, specific difference between divine purposes and divine command theories? Like, could you just tell us what it, maybe in a sentence or two, exactly what the difference between those two are?
Yes, indeed. I might say that divine purposes theory is a modified divine command theory. Is a modified divine command theory, okay. Because it takes into consideration that commands and prohibitions were issued for a reason. And this is a theory that can be applied in jurisprudence, can be applied when people derive laws in order to protect or safeguard their well-being. However, divine command theory, as articulated early by al-Ash'ari, it strictly says that there are no reasons behind what is commanded and prohibited. He even went to the extreme of saying that God prohibited indecency, and if he did otherwise, then indecency would be good rather than evil. God prohibited stealing, but if he did otherwise, then stealing would have become obligatory. That is divine command theory. There is no reason at all behind what is commanded or prohibited. However, divine purposes theory, there are reasons behind what is commanded and prohibited. If there are reasons, then me and you and somebody who is a Christian and a Jew and a Buddhist can actually agree on those reasons, because the reason is something that we all as human beings share. However, commands and prohibitions is not.
So what is exactly the difference between ethical objectivism and what is the difference between ethical objectivism and this divine purposes theory? What is left out of divine purposes?
Ethical objectivism can have different meanings, indeed. But when we are talking about the Mu'tazilite ethics, even the early Mu'tazilite, they tried to establish theories of values to define good and evil, to define good and evil a part of religion. So they were looking whether good and evil are those actually kind of entities that exist in objects. So they are objective, you know. Are they actually something that all the people can understand, can feel, and can know by with their reason?
Moral intuition, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes. So if there is actually if something that everybody can agree upon, we think that everybody can agree upon, it is objective. Like, for example, if I tell you that this is the color of this object is green, it is something that you and me can agree upon. But when we are talking about divine command theory, they say it is subjective because it completely depends on the arbitrary will of the divine. It does not assume that God has purposes. It assumes that what establishes morality is the arbitrary will of God. You can't say that God is good, because that will take us to the question, what is good?
Right. So I guess my question is, where does the divine purposes theory stop short of joining the ethical objectivism? So what is the main difference between the modified divine command theory? What is it that it leaves behind from objectivism? What does it not sort of entail? And why? What is the distance between them? What is that gap that can't be traversed or connected or...
I think, Banafsha, that there is no gap between divine command, between divine purposes theory and ethical objectivism. We can still say that the divine purposes are objective, that they are nothing else but the purposes of human beings, because divine purposes, al-maqasid al-sharia, as established by many Muslim scholars, are to preserve life, to preserve intellect, to preserve your religion, to preserve your progeny, and to preserve your property. So those are actually also the purposes and the priorities of any human beings. We can say that the divine command, the divine purpose theory or maqasid al-sharia is objective theory, can be objective theory. We can all agree on it. We can all agree on those purposes that are human purposes and divine purposes. But the gap is that there is something strange, which is that the meta-ethical theory behind divine purposes theory is lacking, or is divine command theory, because they still, when you ask them why, what is good and what is evil, somebody like Abu Hamid al-Ghazali or al-Ash'ari would insist that good is what is commanded by God, evil is what is prohibited by God. So I think that maybe there should be a kind of a study, of a critical study of Ash'arite theology, in order to put divine purposes theory, maqasid al-sharia, in its right ethical context, or in to give the proper meta-ethical theory that will provide the basis of divine purposes theory and make it appeal more to the normal Muslim to different Muslims over the world, or to, let's say, if we can say, progressive Muslim thinkers. Yes, my dear, I think so.
Okay. Wow. I think I know what your next book is going to be about. or maybe your third book, we were talking a little bit about your next book. In fact, that's what I kind of want to talk to you about. What is the project that you're working on right now? Can I ask you?
I am working on a book also in Islamic ethics, but that will deal with Islamic ethics from different perspectives. So I will try to write a part on meta-ethical theories in Islam and a part on normative ethical theories in Islam. And the final part will be on applied ethics in Islam to see how normative ethics can be applied to some applied ethical issues, contemporary applied ethical issues.
Which actually brings us to, maybe one of two or three wrap-up questions if we have time. But I think, not only I, but perhaps the people who will be listening to this would like to know what sort of reverberations the use of divine purposes theory could have for fiqh, for kalam, for Islamic studies or Muslims' lives on the ground in general. How do you see that sort of unfolding?
I think that's
a bunch of questions in one question. Sorry.
I think the Nafshah, that there are many scholars who worked on this Maqasid al-Sharia. Recently, many people worked on this. And there is a big difference between different individuals working on Maqasid. There are some people who are taking it more to the, let's say, kind of, they are focusing on the secular aspects of the theory, we can say. They are trying to find other purposes other than those traditional purposes that were stated by theologians 1,000 years ago. And there are also some more conservative thinkers who are trying to focus on the theory of Maqasid as being a Sharite theory, which is a traditional theory, conservative theory, and that those Maqasid are derived from the Quran, and that they are literally derived from the Quran, and we can't add to them, we can't interpret them in different ways, because they emphasize that they are divine, that there is no human element in establishing Nadhariyat al-Maqasid. I think that there is a lot of human element in establishing Nazariyat Maqasid al-Sharia. Even Muhammad al-Ghazali, although he didn't acknowledge that, must have observed the human condition when he established the five universal morals that are preserved by law, which is life, progeny, property, and so on. And I think that after 1,000 years, maybe people have to revisit that theory, maybe have to revisit the purposes of that need to be preserved by law. And maybe also that will include the purposes that we need to preserve by ethics, because not every issue that is moral or ethical, you want to see it enforced by law, of course. So I'm not sure where would that study lead us, but I hope that during the coming few years or maybe a few decades, there will be some scholars who would elaborate on Maqasid al-Sharia theory and will add something that would be very convincing and useful for human being. And I think that this theory is a wonderful theory that would benefit even the non-Muslim who are interested in the field of ethics, because it is kind of utilitarian theory in a way, but which sets the priorities, and the priorities, it's not pleasure, for example, it's not any benefit, it is the essential universal principles that are the priority for any human being that need to be preserved first. So I think that it might be very useful to work on this theory and try to put it in the proper framework, in the proper meta-ethical framework, which is that it is a theory that is human for humans, for every human being, regardless of their religion. And at the end, isn't the Islamic religion meant to be universal and for every human being? And isn't religion actually meant to be, meant to amend morality? Every great prophet or every great teacher first wanted to amend morality, wanted to reform society. So if Muslim thinkers can add something to this theory, they would be able to participate in the debate of ethics on a universal level, rather than confine themselves in the circles of Muslim theologians and Muslim jurists.
Mariam, you spent a very interesting good, you know, I think a chapter or two, definitely chapter three, on pre-Mu'tazilite ethical doctrines. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because we all think it all started with the Mu'tazilites.
Yeah, indeed. I thought that maybe not much has been written about the history of moral philosophy in Islam, apart from what is traditionally considered to be philosophy. That's written by Farabi, Ibn Sina, and other philosophers. So I was studying, indeed, the doctrines and the theories that were of the Khawarij, the Kharijites, and the Murji'a, who were, of course, who came before the Mu'tazila. And I shed some light on the Qadarites as well, al-Qadariya, and Ahl al-Hadith. Eventually, that led me to talk about the Mu'tazila and the similarities between their moral views and the views of the Khawarij. And there are many similarities between some of the Kharijite sects and the Mu'tazila. Yeah, and I guess that chapter on the five principles of the Mu'tazila, the five principles the Mu'tazila interpreted as moral philosophy is a chapter that I would really like to highlight. So I was talking about usul al-khamsa of the Mu'tazila as moral philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is there, now that we're sort of talking about your book, is there a favorite part that you have? Is there a section that sort of encapsulates the rest of the book for you?
Well,
part that you enjoyed writing more than others?
Yes, I think that the last two longest chapters that are dedicated to the study of the Mu'tazilite ethical theory, as culminated in the Ethics of Abdul Jabbar, are my favorite ones, and also the last chapter, which speaks about the divine purposes theory, is also one of my favorites. Indeed, because we are talking there about the meaning of moral judgments, what is the meaning of good, what is the meaning of evil, according to Abdul Jabbar and some other Mu'tazilite teachers. And there is an analysis of moral judgments of what is wajib, what is obligation, what is mahdur, what is prohibited, what is mandub, recommended, and so on. So chapter 5 and 6 are more philosophical than the previous ones. Chapters from 1 to 4 mainly talk about history, about different concepts, explaining, highlighting different theories and concepts. But I think that chapter 5 and 6 are mainly philosophical chapters where I am trying to reconstruct the moral philosophy of Qadi Abdul Jabbar al-Mu'tazili, who died in 1025. And those are the two chapters that I think are important, more than anything else in the book.
Mariam, a lot of folks have written about Qadi Abdul Jabbar, and I guess my question is, writing as an ethicist, how is your presentation of these ideas different?
how are my presentation of these ideas different?
Of the Mu'tazilite, yeah. Rationalism and...
Yes, indeed. George Hurani was among the first to write Al-Qadi'ah about the ethics of Al-Qadi'ah Abdul Jabbar. And he kind of interpreted the theory of Abdul Jabbar as being primarily and mainly deontological theory. I am interpreting the ethics of Al-Qadi'ah Abdul Jabbar as being primarily teleological theory. And that's what allows us to link it to the doctrine of Al-Maslaha and to the theory of divine purpose, or to the theory of Maqasid al-Shari'a or divine purposes theory. I am interpreting Mu'tazilite ethics as teleological theory in ethics, which is different than what has been previously done by George Hurani, who was one of the first and the most important authors who wrote about Al-Qadi'ah Abdul Jabbar. And I so think
Can you tell us what teleological ethical theory is?
A teleological ethical theory is a theory where what is good and what is evil, or what is right and what is wrong, is related to the consequences of the action.
Say consequentialism. So, okay.
Mm-hmm. It's consequentialism. Yes.
Cool.
Where the ontological is simply following rules, although those rules are of course beneficial to people, but the ontological, like the ethics of Kant, where we are talking teleological theory, like the most prominent of all, most famous theory in Western ethics would be utilitarianism, of course. So I'm interpreting Mu'tazilite ethics as being primarily teleological, although it, of course, also it contains some deontological elements which are very clear and obvious in his theory.
Maryam, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? This has been so illuminating for me personally, and you've been so clear, and I've just learned so much. I was wondering if you have any closing thoughts, maybe something that has been left out that you want to talk about.
Nothing, my dear. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And indeed, some questions were really challenging since I haven't read the book since 2 years. You took me back to the book and you forced me to highlight some things which I believe should have been highlighted. So thank you for allowing me to
next
talk
book,
about
next this. Book, next
I
book.
I enjoyed it, my dear. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Maryam. Hopefully we will connect soon and we'll be talking about your next book. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.